like an animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animal. Talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Rebecca Reed, Director of Education at Bush Wildlife Sanctuary in Jupiter Farms, Florida. A multifaceted operation serving as wildlife refuge, veterinary hospital, rehabilitation facility, and education center, the sanctuary relocated within the last year to a nearly 20-acre spread, providing more room for its approximately 200 resident animals, as well as larger spaces for the educational programs Reed administers. Reed, recently named a finalist in Palm Beach Illustrated's annual Educator of the Year Award, has worked at the sanctuary's Director of Education for more than 8 years. It's hard to imagine someone with a better calibrated educational background for the job. She holds a bachelor's degree in biological science from FAU and a master's certificate in environmental education. She's also a Florida master naturalist, and boy, is there a lot of educating, I guess I should say, going on at the Bush Wildlife Sanctuary. Reed leads a team of educators who greeted upwards of 12,000 school children to the sanctuary last year, including serving over 2,500 disadvantaged students through its education programs. I'll discuss the array of education efforts at Bush Wildlife Sanctuary and more, including this Educator of the Year nomination, when I speak with Rebecca Reed in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. A programming note, next Wednesday, July 31st, Bev Capshaw will be hosting Talking Animals, during which she'll lead a discussion about a program that focuses its efforts on the endangered and elusive, very elusive, Florida panther. This discussion promises to be fascinating, so that's next Wednesday right here on Talking Animals with Bev Capshaw on Florida panthers. Meanwhile, coming up later in today's program, I'll play back a talk with H.H. German, the founder of Sigma Comics and writer-director of Calico, featuring what's believed to be the first comic book hero dedicated to fighting animal abuse. We've spoken to German periodically over the years since Sigma Comics launched the Calico series, which has been lauded in comic book and animal welfare circles. They've arrived at a new milestone, releasing their first trade book starring the mighty Calico. I recorded a brief conversation with German yesterday. Right now, he's actually traveling across the country to the San Diego Comic-Con, where the trade book will be officially unveiled. I'll play back this conversation later in today's show. Right now, though, let's discuss the education of all kinds provided at Bush Wildlife Sanctuary, overseen by our guest today, Rebecca Reed. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Rebecca Reed to Talking Animals. Good morning, Rebecca.
Hi, Duncan. How are you?
I'm doing really great. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So I look forward to learning more about you first, and then also what you do at the sanctuary. But first, I want to kind of start with an observation. I've never had the pleasure of meeting you in person, but I do live kind of basically around the corner from Bush Wildlife, and I know kind of, I think I know what you do, but we're going to learn more about that shortly. But it appears to me that you absolutely love what you do. How accurate is that observation?
That would be a very accurate observation, of course. I mean, there's not many jobs in the world that allow you to do what you really, really love, which involves animals and education. So super awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you found your calling, but let's talk about how you arrived there. Maybe we can kind of reverse engineer the path that you took to get there. Starting with back when you were a kid, what did animals mean to you when you were growing up?
I always really enjoyed being outdoors as a kid. We would always go off on our bikes and go off an adventure and find weird little creatures under rocks and whatnot, because I grew up in New Jersey, so we had like salamanders and all that cool stuff. I specifically remember always finding baby bunnies and wanting to help them, and I just really, really enjoyed animals growing up. I had pets all the time. I always had a rabbit, a dog, or a cat, something along those lines. So yeah, an animal lover from the start.
And when you talk about finding some of those animals, I'm guessing that perhaps some of the animals you found, if they were injured or ailing in some way, were you one of those kids that tried to help fix them up or nurse them back to health?
Always, especially with those baby bunnies. And now I know better. But when I was a kid, yeah, whenever I found something, I really wanted to help it, whether it was a baby bird that fell out of the nest. But when I was growing up, there wasn't really a place like Bush Wildlife that I know of that existed. So there was nowhere for us to really take them. We just kind of, you know, brought them into our house, did the best we could, and best of luck.
Yeah, it is a best of luck situation. And one of the great things about Bush, among many, so many other things, is that if you do happen to be trying to do the right thing or what you think is the right thing, and you see like a tiny bunny that's like by itself and may or may not be stranded or injured or whatever, I mean, they will guide you, or I should say you will guide us, since I'm talking to a Bush education person, you know, on what really to do and what not to do, because sometimes someone's instincts to really help an animal that they think is in distress is actually kind of counterintuitive to what's actually the best thing.
Oh, 100%. We have 24-hour phone service, actually, so anyone can call anytime, question an animal, and we'll walk you through it, whether it's animal alone or bring the animal to the sanctuary.
Yeah, I even think, if I'm not mistaken, I saw something, I think, on the website where you can click on something, like if you've found or you've spotted at least an injured animal or bird, and it kind of, I guess, sort of gives you the procedure from there.
There is, yeah. There's a click if you found an injured animal, and it's supposed to guide you through, and I believe there's even a flow chart that might even come along with it at the very bottom, that if you find a baby bird or you find a baby animal, and it's kind of like a yes or no. And then if you get to the point where it says leave it alone or call Bush Wildlife, you know, that's probably one of the easiest ways that you can kind of figure out if you need to bring it or not.
Yeah. And again, it's not specific to that area. I mean, obviously, if you're, you know, over on this side of the state or really anywhere, you could click on that same, you know, same kind of thing and get the information that would help you. I mean, obviously, you couldn't bring it into Bush, but you could figure out what to do next if they did say to take it into a wildlife rehabilitator or somebody that was going to help you in the same way. So it's kind of universal help. So back to New Jersey days, because I was going to ask you, like, what animal or animals you first loved, and it sounds like bunnies might be right up there.
Yes, bunnies were always up there. Gosh, growing up, I had quite a few bunnies. One of my favorites. I always came up with really fun names. I had Ichabod Moon, and I had Maximilian Cadbury. So, and then more recently, I had Dipster Fitzgibbon. So, yeah, rabbits are always a staple in my life. And then I always had a dog growing up and a cat. And now, right now, all I have is a kitty cat. I can't take on anymore.
Is that just because the rigors of your job are such that it's just too hard to kind of look after other animals as well?
That, and I also need to reel it in because I'd probably want to keep and take in everything.
Oh, I see. So you're trying to like get a grip on things a little bit. Yeah, I gotcha. So do you remember when you started thinking, obviously I love animals, and I really love animals. Did you remember start thinking to yourself, I wonder if there's any way to actually work with animals, or like, I wonder if there's some kind of something I could do with animals as my job, or put it the other way, when did you first kind of have that conversation with yourself? Because at some point you obviously did.
Yeah, well, believe it or not, it actually took me a while to even figure out what I wanted to do. It took me a while to finish college. I was just kind of like cruising along, I guess. You know, you get kind of complacent and you just do what you need to do. So yeah. For the longest time, I actually worked in a restaurant, and then I worked at a law firm. And then I decided that I wanted to finish up school. So I finished up my bachelor's degree in biological sciences. And from there, that's actually when I discovered Bush Wildlife Sanctuary, roughly around then. So Bush was probably one of my first where I was like, I want to be here. This is where I want to work. And from there, I started to volunteer, and then I applied after I graduated from school, and essentially the rest is history.
So really, it sounds like once you went back to school and got your degree, that sounds like that dovetailed with when you kind of discovered Bush. And then, so between volunteering initially upon the discovering and then kind of what's happened since, has that been kind of what you've done pretty much, like, there have been no other real jobs or even volunteer positions dealing with animals other than Bush?
No, not in any other capacity. I've been at Bush Wildlife for about 10 years. So in November, it'll be my 10th year. I first started out in the animal care department, where the animal care team, they're basically the zookeepers. They take care of the animals. They help to feed them, clean them, provide them enrichment. And after that, I switched over to the education department. The woman who ran the department then was like, I think you'd be really good at this. And I was like, okay, cool. So I did for about a year, and then she left, and I was like, I want to do this. This is what, you know, this is my calling. So from there, I asked the current director, you know, hey, I want to do this. Can I do it? And he's like, you've been doing it. So yeah, of course, take it on.
Well, isn't that great, though, how things kind of sometimes just unfold that way? And even though it sounds like from growing up, animals were always super important to you, you kind of... Sounds like you kind of took a slightly circuitous route, like when you weren't going to school before you resumed going to school. At that point, you probably wouldn't have predicted, hey, I'm going to be working with animals, even though as a kid, somebody might have looked at you or you might have looked at you and said, this is an animal person.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Everything just kind of clicked.
Yeah. No, but it's just funny how sometimes it was a little bit of a detour to get to something that probably was exactly the right thing for you all along. It always takes everybody a little while sometimes to find their way. And sounds like that was the case. But it sounded like once you found your bush, you were like, hey, this is exactly the right place for me. I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this, and then I've got a job here.
Yep, exactly.
Is that when you went on to get other education that supported the position that you ended up with at Bush?
Yeah, so the Florida Master Naturalist is actually a really cool program that's offered, and pretty much anybody can do it. You essentially just sign up, and it's the coolest thing I've ever done when it comes to, like, environmental education and whatnot, because it's not just for environmental educators, it's for anybody. So when you go to those programs, it's an accountant, it's a lawyer, like people that are just interested in it. So you meet people from all different walks of life, and you do these really cool field trips and whatnot. So I really enjoyed that. And then more recently, over the last couple of years, I was taking one class at a time to complete my master's certificate program. That was in environmental education, and that was a really awesome program as well. And it's kind of set me up for success to do exactly what I'm doing right now, and how I'm going to essentially build the education program at the new Bush Wildlife Sanctuary.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, it sounds like you slowly but surely have just kind of like fortified your own educational background to do this job and keep adding to it and expanding based on your own expanding education.
Absolutely. And people always ask too, after you talk to them for a little while about animals, they're like, how did you learn all this? And I just basically tell them, like, you just have to read. You know, read everything you possibly can about these guys, and you will learn. So that's my suggestion to everybody. I'm not just an educator. I teach myself all the time.
So it sounds like beyond whatever educational things specifically for degrees and certificates, they're also kind of educating yourself at every opportunity just by whatever book you can pick up next.
Absolutely.
Because Bush Wildlife Sanctuary clearly places a significant premium, I would say, on education. So at the risk of sounding kind of like a dummy myself, why exactly is education so monumentally important to you and your sanctuary colleagues?
Yeah, of course. The education is core. It's actually one of our missions, parts of our mission, because 90% of the animals that are admitted into our rehabilitation center are brought in due to some sort of human-related cause. So if we can take that and take that information and we can kind of flip it around in order to essentially teach people about the animals that are in our environment, about how to coexist with them, hopefully those interactions and those animals being brought in because of those human interactions will be minimized.
Yeah, that makes sense. And maybe it occurs to me as we're talking now, even though we've featured the Bush Wildlife Sanctuary on the show in the past, and we've had Amy on and others, maybe just for the purpose of this discussion, you could just talk about kind of what primarily happens, like what kind of animals usually end up there and what kind of animals end up being, well, ideally at least, rehabilitated and released, and what kind of animals for whatever reason can't be, and so they end up being ongoing residents of the sanctuary.
There's over about 6,000 animals that are admitted into our wildlife hospital, and we try our best to rehabilitate and release every single one of them. We want them to be out in the wild and doing wildlife, you know, animal things. If we can't rehabilitate them and we feel that they would have a decent quality of life in the sanctuary, we keep those for as our animal ambassadors. And I think that those animals, particularly the ones that are living in the sanctuary, have a really important job. Their job is to teach people about them. So we have, let's say, a lot of birds come in, and we're talking birds of prey. Many of them will have some sort of a wing injury. Maybe it's due to falling out of a nest at a young age, hitting a tree because they're flying and they hit something. Some of them are even missing eyes because they maybe ran into a tree or were hit by a car. There's a lot of different types of animals and different reasons. Many of our deer that come through the sanctuary are essentially kidnapped. You know, when it comes to deer, the mom leaves them for the majority of the day. She only comes back to feed them. And if someone sees a deer laying there in the woods all by itself, your first instinct is, oh my goodness, that deer needs help.
Yeah.
So then, of course, want to help them. So there's a lot of different reasons why the animals come in. But the whole point of the education team is to really try to work with people and try to educate them on you know, when I say coexisting with them, is knowing when to help and when not to help and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and isn't that such a critical thing? Because, again, like the deer example you just gave, and I myself have at least once or twice before I kind of understood that it was the opposite thing to do, have brought a bunny that I thought needed help to the sanctuary. And it's like, oh, if you had just left the bunny alone, he would have been fine, pal. But again, people make those kind of mistakes because they don't look around and see that the mom bunny's nearby and everything is cool. They just think, here's a bunny, a little baby bunny that's been stranded or deserted or whatever, so I'm going to try to help. So it's well-meaning, but it's the kind of thing that your educational efforts help kind of mitigate.
Absolutely. I mean, most of it is well-meaning. Everybody wants to help, but like you said, the whole point is to educate so that we can minimize that.
Yeah, well, it just definitely seems like there's kind of a central ethos of the sanctuary is education in all kinds of ways, which is what we'll talk more about, some of the even broader programs that you do. But it sounds like you say, the kind of a chief goal is if we can educate just more broadly the public about how things work, and it kind of start to reverse the ratio of the 90% rehab the cases that come in because humans were involved in some capacity, if that can be altered, or I don't know if it can be flipped all the way around, but it could certainly be altered. That'll make a huge difference for the animals and for what you guys do. So over the 8 years, I know you've been there almost 10, I think, total, but I think it's about 8 years plus as director of education. To what extent do you think you shaped kind of the educational programming at the sanctuary? In other words...
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
No. You were saying in other words.
Well, I was going to say, like, how have the education programs at the sanctuary evolved over those 8 years in terms of philosophy or mission or just being refined in a certain way or developed in a certain direction under your under your leadership?
So I feel like our education programs are always evolving. As we learn more, we try to change and update things. But with this move from the old sanctuary to the new location, my whole entire goal was to change the kind of like the structure and the layout of the programs that we offer to our school children, essentially. So we have public schools, private schools, homeschool groups, lots of different types of students that come through. And starting this school year, actually, we're going to be doing our programs a little bit differently. So what I'm really excited to do is we're actually going to be treating our educational amphitheater more like a classroom instead of this amphitheater style. Like, I want the kids to sit on the floor and get their hands dirty and talk and play and discuss things. So I want them to be almost like little teeny tiny scientists.
Cool.
And then when they go out onto the trails, instead of just like looking at the animals and listening to what we have to say, I want it to be more interactive. So I want the kids to be able to touch things. We're going to have artifacts along the trails, stations where we'll have volunteers that are there to essentially hold out manipulatives for the kids to play with and answer any questions that they have. So that really, honestly, probably like the biggest transition that I'm trying to make from our old programming to our new programming. But over the years, we have so many different types of community events that we have hosted and have gone to. So we do local festivals. We are doing Spanish language programming. We have ASL programming. We've done programs for the blind, which I think is really, really different. It's very cool. We have our Happy Trails program, which is where we actually go out to some of the natural areas that we have adopted through ERM, which is Environmental Resources Management, and we get out into the actual wild doing a little mild hike, and we poke around at things, and we check out plants, and we try to identify them. So we have all of those awesome programs that we've been doing and that we're trying to build upon. And then I can't forget to mention our Junior Naturalist program, which is basically a program made for children ages 5 to 14 years old. We have homeschool kids that come. We have kids that go to regular school on Saturdays. But that program itself is kind of teaching the kids how bush wildlife sanctuary works. They learn about the animals. They learn animal husbandry. They do public speaking. They help us with our programs. It is probably one of the most amazing programs that we offer at the sanctuary.
Well, that sounds great to have students in that age range doing that kind of hands-on stuff and even getting public speaking experience, which of course is just so great whatever age you can get in. If you can get it and get over the nerves and fear of that younger, that makes such a difference no matter which direction you're going. So that sounds fantastic. Okay. So, Rebecca, how much of what you just described, and we'll get into some specifics of other stuff in a moment or two, is the product of the relocation of the sanctuary? And how much of it is just kind of like you've been doing this a number of years and probably taking note and comparing notes with some of the things that you learned in your own educational path and your all your outside reading and stuff. So how would you pinpoint the sort of evolution of the programs to shifting from, like what you said, is kind of more kind of lecture teaching kind of thing to what will become, it sounds like, this coming year, more interactive and more involved and again, kind of fostering, like you say, kind of young scientists?
So it's definitely trial and error is a really big thing.
Yeah.
I think, you know, as an educator, it's hard to put something on paper and then have it work every single time 100%. So over the years, we've definitely tried things and things have not worked, and then we've stuck with things that have worked. But my environmental education, the master's certificate that I've worked on, has really kind of guided me in learning different teaching styles, teaching methods. And then, of course, there are standards that public school students need to meet. And some of those standards are, it's not just sitting in a classroom and learning about things. Like, they want the children to be critical thinkers. They want them to be asking questions.
Yeah.
So in order to really meet that need and wanting the kids to really explore their surroundings and their environment, I want them to be more free thinking in the programs that we offer. Instead of essentially, you know, talking at them and lecturing to them, I want them to be asking us questions and being able to answer them for them.
And that shift, it sounds like you're able to more fully implement this coming school year. So you haven't really had a chance to. Or have you had any kind of like sort of pilot programs or trials of this so far?
Actually, no. And it was essentially like when we started our move last year, I really wanted to try it out this first year that we've been at the sanctuary because we opened our doors last October.
Yeah.
However, with move and everything else that happened and needing to be open right away because we're a nonprofit, doors closed means no money, no money coming in.
Sure.
So there wasn't really a ton of time to develop those programs, but I guess buckle your seats here because we're in for a wild ride this October. It'll be our pilot program. It'll be a lot of fun.
No, that sounds great. And again, kind of back to what I observed at the beginning of our conversation, I mean, these efforts and this adjustment and experimentation to me are all reflective of just you're like a born educator with all the, I guess, instincts and sort of objectives that go with that. Just curious, are there teachers or other educators in your family?
That's a very good question. In my direct family, no, I don't know anyone that was actually, there is one teacher, my Aunt Pat. She was a school teacher, but otherwise no one that I know was like, you know, a born educator like I am. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. No, but that, I mean, because sometimes you find that like there's families where people, even if they're teaching different things across at least an extended family, you get people like, well, there's two or three teachers here, and they're just kind of, it's almost like not quite a family trait, but you do find it commonly. But it sounds like that's not generally the case in your in your family. But I just thought, since you obviously have such a strong desire and inclination and talent for it, that that might be shared with other family members. But it sounded like just Deanna.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. But no, there's, as far as I know, there's not really anybody who is a an actual formal teacher or anything like that. But of course, my mom has a big, she has a saying where whenever I do a program or whenever she talks about me, she's like, I don't know where she got it from, because my mom does not like animals and she also doesn't like to public speak or anything like that. So,
wow.
I guess I'm a wild card.
Yeah, you're a rebel for sure. That's great, though. I mean, that's great that you can be so different, because it was just clearly the path that you should be on, and you just kind of found your way and just kept going, and it sounded like you couldn't be happier doing it.
Thank you.
This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Rebecca Reed, Director of Education at Bush Wildlife Sanctuary, a 20-acre operation in Jupiter Farms, Florida, housing about 200 animals and offering a vast array, as we're discussing right now, of education programs. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So how much has the new facility, do you think, affected the education programming, or will that really be only more known when you try implementing the new approach come October? I mean, has it expanded at least the facilities or the places that you can do some of the things that you're going to try to do differently?
Yes and no, just because at this point, we have only been open for a year, so we're still kind of working out what we can and cannot do and what we can and cannot accommodate, if that makes sense. You know, moving from the old sanctuary we were only built on about 6 or so acres. This one is almost 20, and the side of the sanctuary where we're doing our tours is like double the size of the one that we used to be at. So, Our tours take a little bit longer. Programs are a little bit different. So it's definitely a big learning curve that we're still trying to tweak and to work on.
Yeah. So let's talk about something more specifically. So even though I know it's going to change, but when a class comes there on a field trip, which I think is a pretty common way for some of the education to happen, is that correct?
Yes. I would say the majority of our education happens through school groups coming through, and then, of course, all the public programs that we offer. We do at least 2 of them per day.
Yeah. So when a class comes there, like on a field trip or some other similar thing, what happens exactly? How does seeing those animals and hearing about them from you or your colleagues seem to affect the students? I mean, many of them probably may not have any animals at home, so this is kind of like not maybe their first, but certainly a rare opportunity to connect with animals or learn about animals or get close to an animal even.
Oh, absolutely. So for many of the kids, it's the first time they've ever seen any kind of wild animal. They don't necessarily see these creatures very often, if at all. So, I mean, the first thing I always like to mention to the kids is if they just take the time and to listen and to see these animals and meet them, they'll eventually not be afraid of them if they are. They'll might kind of like them eventually, and then they might even start to love them just like we do at the sanctuary and want to help them. So my ultimate goal is to try to just alleviate any kind of stressors that they have about seeing any wild animals and making it more of a fun, pleasurable treat for them. Whenever we have one of our programs in our seated amphitheater, the amount of children that are afraid of all of the animals, let alone something like a snake, is kind of wild when you think about it. But by the end of the little talk that we'll have about the snake, the kids are like, oh my gosh, this is the coolest thing ever. So to see them kind of flip-flop from being afraid of something to being like intrigued by it and wanting to learn more is like the entire goal. It's so exciting to see.
No, that sounds really great, because I was going to ask, like, with the initial thing you were explaining there about some concerns that some kids have, like if you pick out specific animals to be part of the presentation as animal ambassadors or otherwise, but it sounds like, you know, because I would have guessed you might have avoided snakes because that's the thing I would think would be the most alarming probably to a lot of kids, but it sounds like that's exactly probably why you do it. It's like, hey, this snake is cool, get familiar with it and see that there's nothing really to be scared of.
Oh, absolutely. Whenever I possibly can. I try to use a snake in every single one of my programs. Any animal that the knowing that someone is afraid of. And it's essentially just to try to show them. Like you said, it's not an animal to be afraid of. Yes, you might not like it. You might not want to be around it, but it's not going to hurt you. So I like to try to share that with children, especially because, you know, by the time you're an adult, you might have already kind of, you know, that is written in stone.
Yeah.
So I try to keep them young, not to be afraid of these things.
That's great. So what other animals are typically featured when a class field trip or a group of students come where they have close proximity to them, like the snake, and what other animals typically are part of that kind of presentation?
Sure. So we typically bring out, we have baby alligators. We have a couple of small ones. They're probably only about maybe about a foot long or so. And then we have a turtle or a tortoise, and the kids love turtles.
Yeah.
We will typically bring out a variety of snake, and of course they're always non-venomous. And we try to bring out an opossum. I like to try to mix it up where we have a variety of reptiles, mammals, and birds.
Great.
So the opossum is always a fun one, especially when many people don't see them or they're kind of afraid of them because, number one, they're nocturnal, so you don't see them ever. But number two, whenever you do stumble across an opossum, they're quite horrifying with their mouth open and they look kind of mangy. And then the last would be some sort of bird of prey, which is usually a hawk, a falcon, or an owl.
So again, and all these animals have arrived at Bush Wildlife Sanctuary because they've been injured or had some kind of illness or been impaired in some way, and then they were deemed unable to be released after attempted rehabilitation. So now they're kind of permanent residents and sort of animal ambassadors for these field trips and other classroom educational situations.
Exactly. And some of the animals that we have, like you said, 200 animals at the sanctuary. So many of those animals do live in the enclosures on the sanctuary trails, and those are not necessarily ones used for education. Many of the ones that we use for, like the birds of prey that we use for education, are typically off the sanctuary trails. They're kind of off on their own. But the animals kind of let us know whether they want to be an ambassador or not. We don't force them to do anything they don't want to do. If it's a bird that it's super, super stressed when we bring out people, it's not one that we're going to use for our programming. So we do have to go through some sort of vetting process with them as well, just to make sure they're as comfortable as possible.
Sure, that makes sense. And I guess from having done this a number of years, you probably have a pretty good feel for, like, well, this bird is not going to be an animal ambassador. This they're spooked or they're stressed or whatever the case may be. So you just probably know intuitively.
You do. And then also, you know, there are days where even your animal ambassadors, just like I have a bad day, they have a bad day too. So, you know, if you notice that they're not feeling so great, it's the day that they get off.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And one thing too, I wanted to be sure to include in our discussion, it appears that education programs for disadvantaged students are enormously important to the sanctuary. Can you talk a little bit about those programs and how those work?
Of course. We are always seeking grants to help us to provide Title I schools and children with any kind of disadvantages access to the sanctuary, because not all of those children, number one, they don't have the funding to come to the sanctuary, or number two, they don't have the means to get there. So they might not have transportation or busing. So the grants that we seek out are specifically for those groups. And last year I did a little bit of math, and we had about 3,000 students from Title I and disadvantaged schools come through. So there's a local organization in Jupiter called El Sol that I absolutely love going to. We do that. We just did that a couple of times over the summertime. I go specifically and I bring in the animal and I teach the kiddos about them. But yeah, it's one of those near and dear programs that we offer because we want those children to experience the animals and the wildlife and the nature. Being outside is good for your soul. So this is an amazing, amazing opportunity for these kids.
And so, Rebecca, in that situation, when you do a program like that for these kind of more disadvantaged students. What difference in the response with the animals and with the presentation you've given do you notice, if any, from school kids that are coming to the sanctuary or that maybe aren't from as disadvantaged a background initially?
Well, many of those children are not exposed to this. They're not exposed to the outdoors. They're not exposed to the animals like some of the other children are. So they... many of them seem a little bit more reserved mm-hmm. when it comes to meeting them. I'm a little more afraid. But like I said earlier, bringing out those animals and introducing them to them, it's such a treat to see them kind of flip sides to realize that these are not scary animals. And then you'll have a certain number of kids in the group that are really, really enjoying it, especially. They know all the answers to the questions. It's just so wonderful to see those kids out and about and really enjoying the nature aspect of it.
Yeah, I'm sure you probably see them kind of like light up and be, you know, really affected, if not transformed, by kind of that exposure and that kind of experience.
Exactly.
And also, I think the sanctuary's education programs are not like solely aimed at school kids. There are opportunities for grown-up types, even if they're just coming by the sanctuary, right? Or are there more specific kind of programs for adults that are any kind of counterpart to the school children programs?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We'll have different organizations that come through. There's senior organizations, there's treatment centers. We have corporate outings at the sanctuary. So I know that the sanctuary itself is, you know, it's one trail, it's all the same animals, but the information that we can give a group of adults is completely different than what you can give a group of kids. So there's always this different delivery of the programs, of the content that we offer, essentially.
Right.
And, we just have a lot of different people, different walks of life come through the sanctuary. We even offer this really cool, the best program that I think we have is what we call our VIP tour, which is everything is basically hands-on behind the scenes. And that's for smaller groups because you can only accommodate a certain amount of people with wild animals in cases like that.
Yeah.
But it's the most hands-on, it's probably the best type of program that we offer because, like I said, everything is just right there at your fingertips.
Yeah, no, that sounds really cool. And there's some animals there that probably in that kind of tour, like the black bears and some of the other cats and stuff that you probably don't necessarily incorporate into the more fundamental programs or presentations, but they're part of those things, which are super cool to be exposed to as well.
Exactly, yeah. So usually during our VIP tours, as long as the bears are cooperating, you can actually feed them.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah.
So we're kind of nearing the end of our time, but we got a question that came in through email saying, what happens to the baby alligators after they get big?
That's a very good question. So the baby alligators that we have currently at the sanctuary are on loan from another facility. So what I like to say is that we babysit them, and then when we're done babysitting them, they go back to their original facility, and then we essentially have this like kind of this swap out program that we do.
But are those baby gators injured or somehow not able to, once they grow bigger, to be released to the wild, or is there some reason that they're, sounds like they might remain in captivity even if they, as they grow up?
Yes. So those alligators in particular are going to remain in captivity. It's basically what happens with an alligator, whenever they're in captivity, you can't release them into the wild because of the fact that they can become very dangerous.
Because they've become acclimated to humans?
So they associate humans with food and they can be very dangerous. For the sanctuary itself, alligators don't come in very often, so we do borrow little tiny ones, and then really we send them back to their facility. And it's another way that we don't want to hoard animals. We don't want to take in baby gators and just keep them in order to use them for education. So we work out with
like
other
a rotation,
how to get a rope going. Exactly.
Gotcha. So at the risk of putting you on the spot, tell me about being named a finalist in Palm Beach Illustrated's annual Educator of the Year feature.
It's actually really funny. So Carolina, our marketing director, she nominated me, and she was just like, I'm really thankful that she nominated me because I didn't think that there would be a chance, I would never think that I would be up for any kind of award like that. And I'm really happy. It's really an honor to be nominated, especially when if you look at me compared to the other educators, I consider myself an informal educator, which is outside of a structured classroom.
Yeah.
We have, I don't have the same 18 kids every single day for the entire year, we see thousands and thousands of school children. So it's a very different type of education that we do. And it's really fun. And I'm so happy to be a part of this. And I'm really excited. And I I don't want to, you know, toot my own horn, but I really hope I win.
Well, to that end, let's just mention that people listening, if they want to vote for Rebecca, you can go to palmbeachillustrated.com and then just kind of search for Educator of the Year. And then you can vote, and I think you can vote by, you have to put in your email, I think, to do so, but then I think you can vote at least once per day until the contest ends. So let's support Rebecca Reed for Educator of the Year. So, and finally, Rebecca, my last question, then sort of we're nearing the end of our time here. Seems like you put in super long days, and I'm sure it will become super long weeks. So when you do get a day off, how do you like to spend that time off? Like, what's an ideal day off for you?
Oh, gosh. Well, this time of year, staying inside because it's very, very hot.
Right.
but let's see. I like to go for walks. I like to go to the gym. And outside of the 9,000 degree heat that we have right now, I like to go outside and enjoy like going out into our yard and doing a little bit of gardening. I really try to promote native plants in my garden.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably one of the more zen experiences that I can have versus, you know, long days at the sanctuary and working with animals and just getting out and enjoying that.
Helps you recharge and chill out a bit from those days, long days at the sanctuary. Cool. Well, that sounds like a good way to decompress, I think, when you can. So that's great. Plus, you have your cat to hang out with. So
I do.
That's
very
great.
Needy.
All right. So we have reached the end of our time. We're speaking with Rebecca Reed from Bush Wildlife Sanctuary. To find out more about the sanctuary itself, you can go to their website. It's bushwildlife.org. And, of course, on socials as well. And but let's also, one more reminder, go to palmbeachillustrated.com, search for Educator of the Year, and put your vote in for Rebecca for that cool thing. So, Rebecca, thanks so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. I learned a lot, and it was really fun, and you're obviously doing great, great work.
Oh, thank you, Duncan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. In a moment, I'll play back my conversation with H.H. Sherman, Sigma Comics founder and writer-creator of Calico, considered the first comic book hero dedicated to fighting animal abuse, becoming over time an acclaimed and very successful comic book series. Sigma's releasing their first trade book during the formidable Calico, unveiling it today at the San Diego Comic-Con. We'll hear the conversation I recorded yesterday with Sherman in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WNF. Right now, though, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with a piece by Al Madrigal. This might be the first time featuring Al in the Comedy Corner, though I've been a fan for many, many years. There's a brief piece called El Raton from Al Madrigal in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Only countries to do this. You know that, Tooth Fairy? Some weird pagan ritual. Doesn't make any sense. You know what they do in Mexico and Spain? Anybody? Raton. Tooth rat. It's a much better system. Think about it. You find out the tooth fairy doesn't exist, you're disappointed. Find out the tooth rat doesn't exist? Huge relief. Doesn't even sound real. Whole thing sounds like a Yakov Smirnoff premise. In my country, we don't have tooth fairy, we have tooth rat. Climbs on your face, sticks rat dick in tooth hole. I love this country.
That was Al Madrigal in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called El Raton, taken from his stand-up special. Now it's time to hear my conversation with Sigma Comics founder H.H. German, the writer-creator of Calico, recognized as the first comic book hero dedicated to fighting animal abuse. So to discuss a new milestone, their first trade book starring the menacing Calico, and recorded yesterday, here's H.H. German on Talking Animals on WMNF. All right, let's welcome back to the show, H.H. German. How's it going, H.H.? Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Absolutely. Thank you, Duncan, for having me. Always happy to be here, and thank you so much for what you do.
For sure. So we've spoken periodically over the years since you really first launched Calico. I'm sure some folks listening today may not have heard at least some of those conversations. Maybe you could just briefly review the impetus, really, to create Calico and how people have responded to this comic book series.
Sure. Well, post-COVID, we had a terrible situation, obviously, worldwide, and I took that opportunity to focus on a passion project. I'm a former boxer from the Bronx, and frankly, I was actually training for some fights, and all of them were canceled. And lady I was dating at the time, she got a book deal and said, hey, why don't you get your book deal idea out off the shelf? And that turned into a comic book dedicated to the fight against animal abuse, featuring the Calico, the ultimate defender of animals. And that's exactly what we've been doing with it. We've been touring the continent with Here Comes Calico, available at SigmaComics.com. And it's been really great. In fact, I just recently received confirmation from one of the largest showrunners on the convention circuit here in America. We're the best-selling independent comic book in the American convention circuit. So that's a great thing.
Wow.
And a great, great feeling to have. Absolutely. And it's thanks to shows like yours that we're able to spread the message.
So let me ask you this. This is in that sort of summary you just gave. You talk about being a boxer, or maybe now former boxer, and the kind of the encouragement you got to, like, from your the woman you were dating at the time about, like, hey, where's your book? But what I guess missing from that, at least that telling of the story, is why aimed at animal rights? Why a hero that had that focus?
Right. Well, comics have always been seminal to my American story. My family immigrated from the Dominican Republic here to New York City back in the 60s. And I was born in the later 70s. And, you know, for me, it was a situation where growing up in the Bronx was a tough way to grow up. Got into a lot of fights. And unfortunately, you know, I saw some animals being abused as well. So that wasn't just kids. And I would step in early on. And, you know, comics being inspirational, part of my story, subsequently went to art school. And I stayed fighting. And it's just, it's always been a passion. I've always loved animals. And frankly, sometimes I like them better than people. So
there's a lot of that going around for sure. Yeah.
There you go.
As we record this interview, HH, you're heading off first thing tomorrow morning to the San Diego Comic-Con. And as you already noted, you've gotten great response to Calico thus far. But also, I think you're launching what I believe is Sigma Comics' first trade book while you're at Comic.
Yep. So absolutely. Big time.
And again, for those not super familiar in this context, what is a trade book?
Yeah, a trade book is, in essence, a graphic novel because it basically collects the initial or, in some cases, total issues of the first run of a comic book series. So in this case, we have an 8-issue comic book series called Here Comes Calico. Well, that series is now going to be collected into one volume, and ours is going to be called The Calico Street Math. And it's going to be a 240-page trade book, and we do have preview copies available that we will make available at the show for the first time ever. And we will then, as we do with all of our comics, we will put it on Kickstarter.com on August 15th to let the public access it and pre-order it. And it's going to be an exciting thing because, like I said, this is our very first trade book.
So, yeah.
Big stuff.
No, it sounds really cool. It sounds very exciting. And does that reflect kind of a wider audience for Calico, or is that like sort of courting a wider audience for Calico?
Absolutely both. There are a lot of people out there that don't read comics, but they will read a graphic novel.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In that capacity, it certainly allows us to reach a wider audience. And then, of course, the incumbent audience is treated to a beautiful volume, all collected. And, you know, whenever you do the trade volumes, you're able to add a bunch of nuggets, obviously the intro and a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that went into the book. So it's a really nice treat for all the people that have been along for the ride.
Well, that sounds great. And if I follow you, people that are at Comic-Con starting tomorrow can, I guess, get their hands on the book, but otherwise officially they won't be available till mid-August. Do I have that correct? Or
yes, it'll be available for pre-order mid-August, so it'll be in people's hands mid-September.
Oh, I got you. Okay, cool.
Absolutely. And we're going to be in Comic-Con, like you mentioned. We're going to be in the small press section in booth L14 in the small press section of the San Diego Comic-Con, and we'll be there all week starting tomorrow.
That sounds great.
Sounds like you anticipate those.
All right, thanks to H.H. German, and in their Comic-Con starting today. Look for Calico and look for that Kickstarter. We're about to hand things off to the conversation. It's WMNF Tampa. We'll see you 2 weeks from now. To next week, it's Bev with Florida Panther Conversation on Talking Animals on WMNF.org. Thanks.